compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, away we go with hour three, 888-914-9149. Call now, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Wisconsin and talk to Steve. Good morning, Steve. Welcome.
Oh, good morning, Patrick. Your previous caller, Terry, calling about her granddaughter who doesn't want to have any kids. And she said she was too selfish in the words of her grandmother. Mm-hmm. Your answer, the reply you gave, and I'm not saying I could have done any better on the spur of the moment, but she said, think of when you're on your deathbed and you could have someone there as opposed to not having a child there. What would your answer be to the granddaughter who said, well, if your goal of having children is to have someone there on your deathbed, is that not indeed a different type of selfishness rather than the consumption of, well, I think you cited frequent flyer miles and vacations? Mm-hmm. How would you answer that grandchild with a reply to that? I'll take the answer off the air. And again, I thank you, Patrick.
Oh, you're welcome, Steve. You're welcome to stay on the line if you want to. I mean, you don't have to hang up.
Well, I'll try. I'm driving, so thank you.
Okay, well, drive safe. I would say, I mean, yeah, I can see that point. And there are some people who might have children for selfish reasons. And if that's the crass and shallow reason that you have children, just so you've got somebody there at your deathbed, yeah, that's selfish. I'd agree with that.
Fair enough. That answer, was problematic from that perspective. And again, I'm not sure I'd do any better when someone calls you and drops a question on you and immediately have to have an answer on the air. So
right.
Have a great morning.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it. Yeah. I mean, live radio, it's like being a trapeze artist without a net. And what is the old saying? Always work with a net. But in any case, yeah, I mean, so that would be, if I wanted to be somewhat glib and respond to that claim, well, you know, if that's the only reason that you're having children is just so you'll have somebody there to comfort you in your old age or on your deathbed, I would agree that would be shallow and that would not really be what I would think of as a generous reason for having children. But I don't think very many people, if any, have children for that reason alone. You know, maybe they're thinking, well, you know, yes, in my old age, I'd love to have sons and daughters who can help me and care for me. I don't know that I call that selfish, but if we want to call it selfish, so be it. But more to the point, though, parents who give God first place in their marriage, and I shouldn't say parents, married couples who give God first place in their marriage and say to God, Lord, you have a plan for us. We don't know exactly what it is. We have our own plans. We have our own goals and dreams and desires, things that we would like to accomplish. Some of them will involve money and some will involve time. And maybe there's a career issue there. And Lord, here is what we would like to do, but we want to subordinate our goals and desires and plans to yours. So you being God, of course, you're going to know better than we do what is best for us, and what we think is best in the moment may not, in fact, be what's best for us. So, Lord, we're praying for these things. We're praying for the nice house, and we would like to do these things. And if it's your will that we do them, then so be it. But if it's not your will, if you would rather that we do something more or different with our life, then we're open to that.
And who would trade one of their children away for a slightly bigger house? You know, it's like, oh, I can imagine this. I've got six kids, and I'm going to imagine one of them away so I can have a nicer car. I mean, it's such a shallow viewpoint.
True, 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 true. I can't imagine anybody actually doing it.
No, of course not. No.
But you know what, though, Cyrus? I'll bet you that there are some people somewhere who are that crass who might do that. But I don't think they're not normal. That's not normal human behavior.
Yeah, I'd say that. I mean, it's...
They're outliers.
I would say there's no one that has kids and they love their kids. How can you imagine that? It's just being, I guess I don't know what I'm trying to say in a concise way.
Yeah.
You love your kids, and can you imagine your life without them once you have them? And
I'm thinking of Babe Ruth.
Like being pro-life.
Let me give you an example. Babe Ruth, his dad, I forget now whether Babe Ruth's mom died in his childhood or she left or something happened. His dad basically just walked him to the orphanage and dropped him off and just said, see ya. because I'm not going to take care of you. And the dad had other priorities. So Babe Ruth grew up in an orphanage, and that's why he was so philanthropic to orphans. And when he, you know, made his mark in professional baseball. But I mean, just one example. I mean, I've always puzzled over that. I mean, how could a parent just like walk away from a child? How could a parent, mom or dad, just abandon one of their kids or sell them, as sometimes happens? You know, I'm not trying to undo the point you're making, Cyrus. I'm just saying that there are some outliers who just don't operate by the same normal set of human standards of behavior that the vast majority of people do. And that's what you're talking about.
Right. And sometimes, you know, putting a child up for adoption or taking him to the orphanage is the most humane thing the person can do. I mean, it's a lot more humane than aborting the child.
This is true. So I don't argue that point.
Right. And of course,
no, I agree with you. But let's just take in the case of Babe Ruth as one example. His dad could have taken care of him. He just didn't want to. You know,
yeah,
he didn't want to be bothered.
That's pathetic.
Yeah. Oh, I completely agree. And I don't want to give anyone the impression that giving a child up for adoption is not the better option by far, especially when the other option is abortion. So I completely agree with that. I'm just using Babe Ruth's dad as an example of a, you know, he strikes me as a deadbeat dad who could have taken care of his son. He just didn't want to. You know, yeah. I'll leave him with the nuns, you know, he'll be their problem.
Yeah, I heard Stephen King's father was along the same lines, and he abandoned the family. And then, you know, after Stephen King became
wealthy.
Guess who tried to get back into his life?
Oh, hey, son.
Yeah, hey, son.
Sorry, I've been out of touch for the last 30 years.
Yeah, can you buy me a boat? I love
you. Well, there you go. Yeah, there you go. Isn't it funny how long-lost members of the family, you win the lottery and suddenly, I mean, it's never happened to me, but you win the lottery and suddenly all kinds of friends you never knew you had and all kinds of relatives who never talked to you, they show up.
Yeah.
But Cyrus, as long as we're on the topic, just briefly, wouldn't you agree that being a parent and participating in God's plan of salvation and procreation by welcoming children into your family, that is not selfish? I mean, you love your children and you're happy to have them there, but at least in my experience, I mean, there's nothing selfish about it, because you have to share your stuff and your time.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things you suddenly now can't do that you're willing to sublimate and to say, rather than doing some of the things I'd like to do or money I'd like to spend on things, I can't now. And I'm happy to do this because I have a new son or daughter. You know what I'm saying, right?
Absolutely. When my kids were young, I thought the baby years were really hard. But I'd often say it's never easy, but it's always worth it.
So true. You know, getting up at 2 a.m. to clean up a vomity kid who's got the flu in the middle of the night, that's not fun. That's not selfish either.
No.
When you'd rather be sleeping.
I've been that dad.
Yeah.
It's not good.
No, but it is so worth it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So young parents, or at least young marrieds, or even those of you who are on your way to marriage and you're not quite there yet, here's the bottom line. If no one's ever told you this, let me tell you this right now. God does not expect, nor does the church require, that you crank out as many babies as you can possibly crank out during your childbearing years. That's never been the church's teaching. Rather, what God is saying to you and what the church echoes is, be open to God's plan for your life. That's it. Be open to God's plan. Now, open doesn't mean, well, I'll consider it. I don't mean open in that sense. What I mean is that when you do what married couples do, that sometimes gives way to procreation, don't do that in a way that would foreclose on the possibility of God giving you a blessing in the form of a child. I'm speaking in roundabout terms, but I think you understand what I mean. Don't employ devices or chemicals or certain actions that would prevent the possibility that God might bless you with life. That's what it means to be open to life. In other words, in your minds and your hearts, you're saying, Lord, here are our plans. We have some goals. We have educational goals. We've got savings goals. We've got a housing goal. We've got other things that we're trying to do, Lord, and you told us to be responsible, and we're trying to be responsible, health-wise, financially, etc. So tell God what your goals are. But still at the same time, let him reserve the right to say, you know what, that's awesome, but I've got something even better for you that you can't appreciate right now, but you will later. Trust me on this one. I'm God, by the way, and I'm in the business of blessing people, and boy, do I have some awesome blessings for you. All I'm asking is that you trust me and that you be willing to receive them. So that's what the church is saying. That's what God is saying. So please don't ever fall under the misconception that you're in some way obligated to have as many children as you possibly can. That's never been the church's teaching. Again, to reiterate, just be open. And by being open, it's not merely an openness of your will, but also in your actions. And in particular, that particular action in marriage should never be done in a way that would prevent, you know, intentionally on your part, that it would prevent the possibility of a blessing in the form of a child. That's it in a nutshell. In which case, if you do that, you're not only going to have a happier marriage. Many marriages experience trouble and difficulties. I mean, the only marriage I know of that didn't would be the marriage of the Blessed Virgin Mary and St. Joseph. But theirs was a unique situation. But pretty much every other marriage is going to go through difficulties, no question. But you want fewer difficulties than more, right? You'd rather have less problems or fewer problems than more. Well, if you adopt this approach and just say, Lord, thy will be done, we're open to your will, whatever it may be, you're going to have fewer problems. You can quote me on that. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Cecilia now in San Antonio. Hi, Cecilia.
Good morning, Patrick. My question is, I started on the first Saturday devotion this past Saturday. However, they didn't have a normal Saturday Mass on Saturday because it's the Saturday before Easter. So I had to go to the Vigil Mass. So I was wondering if that counts towards my five Saturdays.
So you went to the Vigil Mass. Well, the Vigil Mass is on Saturday. So which Vigil Mass are you referring to?
Saturday.
All right. We're having some kind of problem with Cecilia's phone. Let me try it again. I don't know if you heard me, Cecilia. So my confusion is that the five first Saturdays, I get that, but the Vigil Mass is on a Saturday. So which Vigil Mass, I mean, if you went to a Vigil Mass on a Saturday, then you made your five first Saturdays, or at least you made that one Saturday. Or am I missing something?
Saturday before Easter, there's no regular Saturday Masses.
Okay, so then how could you go to a Vigil Mass then?
There's just the regular Saturday Vigil Mass that is actually a Sunday Mass.
Oh, I see. So you did go to Mass on Saturday, but it was the Vigil Mass for Sunday. Okay, you made your five first Saturdays.
Yes, I was just wondering, since it was actually a Vigil Mass, because there weren't any regular Saturday Masses, whether that counts.
Yeah, I understand that now. Yeah, that does count.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Let's see, we'll go now to Jose in, where is Jose? In, I can't even see it, Beloit, Wisconsin. Do they say Beloit where you are, Jose?
Yes, sir.
Okay, welcome.
Good morning. Good morning to all the Relevant Radio team.
Thank you.
I want to go a few calls back to the gentleman who called. I think it was a few calls back. He was saying about how the priest was saying God expects you, God knows you're going to sin.
Yeah.
That's what the priest was telling him. Am I correct?
Well, he used the phrase, you're expected to sin because you're human. I think that might be what you heard.
I see. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sure.
I've heard somewhat the opposite from a priest. I've heard a priest told me, God doesn't expect you to be perfect, but he does expect you to be faithful. And I take that as avoiding sin. Not that I want to correct anybody, but that's what a priest told me personally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I realize you're not seeking to correct anybody, nor am I for that matter. Well, the more popular version of that that I've heard is God does not expect you to be successful. He expects you to be faithful, or he doesn't want you to be successful. He wants you to be faithful. I think that's the form, and I think it came from St. Mother Teresa, if I'm not mistaken. So let's look at that. Jesus said to the woman taken in adultery, he said, your sins are forgiven. Go and sin no more. So in addition to forgiveness and mercy, there's also that admonition to stop doing that. And that would be true of any sin, of course. So part of what we bring with us into the confessional, into the sacrament of confession, is what we call the firm purpose of amendment, meaning that although only God knows the future, and I don't know, and you don't know what weakness you might fall into in the future, God understands our weakness. That's why he gives us the remedy for it in the sacrament of confession. But in the here and now, in the confessional, what's required is that you have the intention to avoid that in the other sins as well. So it's not us saying, Lord, you know, I guarantee you I'll never fall into any sin ever again. That would be foolish because it's extremely unlikely. But at least the intention to do everything we can to avoid the sin, that's what God wants from us. That's why he said to the, that's why Jesus said to the woman taken in adultery, go and sin no more. And Jesus said, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. So when I hear somebody say, well, God doesn't expect you to be perfect, I would say, no, God himself, Jesus, said to strive for perfection. And it doesn't mean that we can do it on our own, obviously, but God can do anything. You remember what Jesus said? He said, with man, this is impossible, but for God, all things are possible, including your perfection. So it's God's grace that will build upon our nature to bring us to perfection. We have to cooperate with it. We have to participate in that plan that God has for our perfection. If we don't participate or won't participate, then we'll never be perfect. And if we fall short in terms of dying in the state of serious sin, then we don't go to heaven, we go to hell. But for those who love God and are seeking to do his will and seeking that perfection that Jesus calls us to, and are allowing and participating God's grace to transform us in that regard, it is possible. These are all part of the elements of, you know, human contrition and forgiveness and restoration and moving forward. You see?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome. I'm glad I could be of service.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You notice, everybody, that one of the more common questions that comes up on this program is confession, because it's such an important and deep area of our faith. The ways in which we the ways in which we get tangled up in our own sins and our own failings, and thankfully, our loving God has there for you. He has a remedy for you to fix that problem, something that you and I can't fix for ourselves. He fixes it for you. But he won't force you. That's the amazing thing. God's not going to grab you by the collar and say, hey, he's going to woo you, and he's going to give you all the opportunities, but ultimately, you're the one that has to say yes or no. What a beautiful thing God's love is for us, don't you think? 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right. A little bit of Cars music, never a bad thing. 888-914-9149. Just want to remind you that, of course, this Sunday is Divine Mercy Sunday. And it just so happens that our very own Drew Mariani, who's got an awesome program every afternoon here on Relevant Radio, he's got a brand new book coming out. Cyrus tells me it's at the printer. And that means it's going to be shipping soon. A huge, huge print run. I don't even know exactly how big it is. I just know it's massive because the number of people who want their free copy of Drew's new book, it's called Divine Mercy, they've been able to get it for free by signing up at relevantradio.com/mercy. And the time is getting short. If you want your free copy, no strings attached, you don't pay a dime, you don't pay a penny, no shipping and handling, nothing. You just go to relevantradio.com/mercy and put your name in there and whatever address you want us to send it to, and we'll send it to you when the print run is finished. But the time is running out, so don't miss the freebie. It's on the table for you. All you have to do is go to relevantradio.com/mercy and give us that information. We'll send you your free book and value added. We will upgrade you by giving you the option to share the same free book offer with your friends and family. And as I said earlier, maybe parents, you've got some kids who are away from God and you're thinking, I've tried everything. I've said everything. I don't know what else to do. Send them a book. And this book will materialize in their mailbox when they're mailed out, and they'll have this beautiful resource to be able to read through. And Divine Mercy is all about miracles, especially miracles of conversion. So if you're waiting for your miracle for someone you care about, don't pass up this opportunity to get a free copy of Drew's book. It's an awesome book by all accounts, and I want you to have one. So again, go to relevantradio.com/mercy and claim your book. And of course, be prepared for God's blessings to you and your family on Divine Mercy Sunday coming up. Let's go now to Sal in Aliso Viejo, California, right next door to where I grew up in Mission Viejo. Hi, Sal.
Hey, Patrick. I got a question. So I made a consecration to Mary, 33 days to morning glory. Mm-hmm. So my question is, now that I put all my prayers and works and things into Mary or in Mary's trust, how do I pray going forward? Do I pray asking for specific things now for my family and friends, and then she gives them out? Or do I just pray to her just a simple prayer, and then she knows my intentions?
I would say neither. Now, there may be those who might disagree with me, but we have to be careful. Let me take a step back. I am very devoted to our Blessed Mother. I've been enrolled in the Brown Scapular of Mount Carmel. I pray the rosary every day. I pay attention to the approved Marian apparitions. So I won't take a backseat to anyone when it comes to my heartfelt devotion to Our Lady. I think I need to say that right up front so what I say next doesn't get misunderstood. We have to remember, we can't lose sight of the fact that, number one, Mary is a creature. She's the highest of all human creatures, of course. She's the mother of God, Jesus himself. So God has blessed her and honored her in ways far beyond anything that you or I could possibly do. But she's still a creature. So that requires that we remember that all blessings come from God. Now, it is true that God imparts his blessings more often than not through intermediaries. So the blessing of baby Jesus not getting killed by Herod's troops was conveyed not directly by God to St. Joseph, but through an angel, one of his ministering servants. So he imparted that blessing through another person, in this case, an angelic person. And par excellence, of course, the greatest of all blessings, the incarnation of Jesus Christ, was given by God through the fiat, the yes that the Blessed Virgin Mary gave to the angel Gabriel. So in a strict sense, it is true that this blessing of Jesus Christ and everything associated with it came to us through the Blessed Virgin Mary. So make no mistake, there's nothing incorrect about any of those details. The problem could be, though, that as human beings, we might not be as diligent in remembering that the source of these blessings is not the Blessed Virgin Mary. She can impart them to us. God can impart them to us through her, like he does through angels. He does it through the Holy Bible. He does it through powerful preaching. He does it through acts of kindness and mercy. So these are all blessings of God that are mediated to us through other people or things even, like the Bible. But if we lose sight of the fact that all of this is ultimately coming from God and is ultimately part of God's own plan of providence for our salvation, then the risk there would be that people, and this would be a terrible thing, would look solely to Mary as if she were the one from whom all these things come. Now, the reason I say that I recognize some people might disagree with me is because there are major figures in the Catholic Church. I'm thinking about St. Louis de Montfort, for example, upon whose work that book, 33 Days to Morning Glory, which is a very good book, drew heavily. But we have to understand it properly, theologically. Otherwise, we can get a skewed understanding and think, well, you know what? That whole God thing, that's great, but I'm just going to pray to Mary now because she's the one who calls the shots. She's the one who decides what's going to happen. So I can really almost kind of sort of forget about God, and I can just ask Mary to do what I want. That would be a gross misunderstanding of her role in God's plan of salvation. Now, maybe maybe you are not laboring under that misconception. I fear that there may be some who are. But that's the way I would answer your question. Don't just say, okay, Mary, you know, you're calling the shots. Don't in any way let that undermine or diminish your daily constant prayers to God himself for those things that you need. What did Jesus say? He said, ask your Father in heaven for the things that you need. Now, it doesn't mean that we can't ask other people to help us with prayer and in other ways of helping. And again, par excellence, we ask the Blessed Virgin Mary to do so by interceding for us. But it would be a serious mistake to lose sight of that fundamental relationship between you and God. I feel like I've said enough on that point. Does that make sense, Al?
Yeah, 100%. So I guess I just continue my daily prayers and my prayer life before I consecrated myself to Mary, and then that will just take care of it, right?
Right, because there should never be any alteration. Only a deepening of that. And this, I hope, will help you, this consecration to Our Lady, I hope will help you recognize her powerful intercession, her powerful desire to help you and intercede for you before the throne of God. And so she will, and so she does. But we should never look to her as if she were the source or she, and she herself would say that. I mean, look in John chapter 2 at the wedding at Cana. What does Mary do after interceding with Jesus on behalf of the married couple and their party? When they ran out of wine, she says to the servants, do whatever he tells you. So Our Lady is always pointing us to Jesus. And that's the important part to remember. Anyway, I feel like I may be repeating myself, but I'm glad you raised the question, Sal. I hope that's helpful to you. Let's go now to Angie in Northern Michigan. Hi, Angie.
Hi, thank you. My question was, this Easter I noticed Jesus said to the good thief on the cross, you know, today I assure you, you will be with me in paradise. But in our creed, we say that Jesus descended into hell for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Could you clarify that for me?
Sure. There's no contradiction between the two. So what happened when Jesus died on Good Friday was that he took the good thief who died shortly after. Remember, the good thief's legs were broken. Oh, well, both thieves' legs were broken to hasten their death. So they died shortly after Jesus died. And so Jesus brought him with him. Jesus brought the good thief with him into Sheol, into Hades, which would be the anglicized version of the Greek word, which means the underworld. And so in the underworld, we see all the people who, from the time of Adam and Eve forward, who were destined for heaven through faith and good deeds, they were waiting there. And then those who were destined for hell, they were waiting in their part of the underworld as well. You can see that in Luke 16 in the parable of Lazarus and the rich man. And you know that the rich man went to the place of fiery torment, and Lazarus went to the place of peace and tranquility with Abraham. And Abraham told the rich man, where you are is separated from us by a great gulf, a great chasm. You can't cross to our side. We can't cross to your side. So there Jesus describes the underworld, and that's where he went. It's called the harrowing of hell. So he went not into the hell of the damned, but he went to this place where the righteous of the Old Testament had been waiting. And this is talked about in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18. It says, for Christ also suffered for sins once, the righteous for the sake of the unrighteous, that he might lead you to God. Put to death in the flesh, he was brought to life in the spirit. In it, he also went to preach to the spirits in prison who had once been disobedient while God waited patiently and waited in the days of Noah during the building of the ark, etc., etc. So then that theme is touched upon again in the next chapter, chapter 4, for this is why the gospel was preached even to the dead, that though condemned in the flesh in human estimation, they might live in the spirit in the estimation of God. So starting with our Lord's death on the cross, that's where he went. He rescued those people, and then he brought them all to heaven. The gates of heaven had been closed because of the sin of Adam and Eve. So they're all now brought to heaven by Jesus, their conquering hero. And then on Easter Sunday morning, Jesus rises from the dead. So there's a little chronology there. Does that make more sense?
Well, thank you so much. Yes, thank you. That's beautiful.
Yeah, I agree. Can you imagine, after waiting who knows how many thousands of years, tens of thousands of years maybe, and finally the big day, Jesus is there. I can't imagine the joy that they must have experienced knowing that they were about to go to heaven, you know?
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Angie. God bless you. Happy Easter. Let's see, Chris in Philadelphia, city of brotherly love. Welcome.
Good morning, Patrick. I just want to thank you first for your listing understandably the five arguments for the existence of God from St. Thomas Aquinas earlier in your program.
Sure,
I just have
welcome.
One question, Patrick. Can you tell me if there are any other saints besides St. Thomas Aquinas who have also listed arguments for the existence of God?
Yes, there have been any number of them. St. Bonaventure, he was one. He propounded what's known as the ontological argument for the existence of God. Because of the importance and influence of St. Thomas Aquinas, he has, I think at least from my sense of it, he has kind of dominated the field since he was alive about 700 years ago. Before him, there were major figures. So St. Bonaventure comes to mind. Also, St. Anselm, St. Augustine was one of the biggest, of course. And so we do see examples of those figures, including St. Augustine, making their case for the existence of God. But they didn't have access to Aristotelian thought categories. And Aristotle was a very precise, you know, slice and dice, laser beam focused. He had an ability to really clarify these difficult issues. And so St. Augustine, as far as we're aware anyway, had no access to Aristotle. So when St. Thomas, because Averroes, the Muslim philosopher who had preserved the writings, he not by himself, but he was an example of somebody who not only preserved the writings of Aristotle and, for that matter, Socrates and Plato, but when those treasures of human wisdom were recovered in the West and they began to be circulated in Latin, which was the language that the people could typically read and write in those days, then it became accessible, and then somebody with a brain like St. Thomas Aquinas's could then take it and refine it and then systematize it and make it more widely available. And it seems to me that since his time, he has really dominated the field because his arguments were so precise and so powerful. That's my take on that, Chris.
Thank you very much, Patrick. And I would just want to thank you quickly for being so friendly to each of we listeners who call in. And last of all, Patrick, for having, in my opinion, the most informative and educational program, an interesting program on Catholic radio today.
I am honored that you would say so, Chris. Thank you. I'm happy you feel that way, and I hope many others do too. Thank you. Nice. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Herb in Miami. Hi, Herb.
Hi, Patrick. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Oh, that's good. I don't know what the question. Why would a person said that God do not exist?
Mm-hmm. I can only speculate because I've never held that view. I've always believed in God. I mean, since I've had the age of reason. But I can speculate. I think in some cases it's because the person is genuinely has genuinely not yet really dealt with or been confronted by the evidence for the existence of God. And so in all honesty, he just doesn't see any reason to believe God exists. Now, that doesn't mean that God therefore doesn't exist. It just means that he's never really encountered the evidence, or he's never had an opportunity to really ponder that. That would be one scenario. Another scenario would be that the person just doesn't want to live a life in which he feels he has to be accountable for his own actions. I mean, let's face it, if God didn't exist and there was no afterlife and you weren't going to get punished for anything in the afterlife and, you know, hell doesn't exist, well, then it would sure make this life a lot more interesting because you could say, well, I mean, really, ultimately, I mean, society might not like it or my wife might not like it or my employer might not like it, but I can do things that I enjoy for the sake of the pleasure and there will be no lasting penalty. You know, if I can do these things and no one's going to hassle me, that's great. You know, and if I can convince myself that God doesn't exist, then all the better, because then I don't have to worry about guilt, feeling guilty for something I've done. Why would I feel guilty? Because if there's no objective standard of morality, if God doesn't exist, then, you know, why not enjoy it? So I could see a scenario where some people may insist that they don't believe in God as a way to drown out their conscience, telling them that there's something wrong with that. That's another possibility. Another possibility, I'll leave it at this, could be somebody who has been scandalized by bad Catholics, bad Christians in general, you know, and maybe they just have a real difficulty in accepting the existence of a God when you've got so many people who profess to believe in God who lead evil lives, or who do terrible things, sometimes even in the name of God. That could be a big reason for somebody hesitating to believe in God. Or the problem of evil. I'll give you one fourth one. You know, these theists, they run around talking about this all-loving God who's all-powerful, and yet there's evil in the world. There's cancer and tsunamis and things of that nature. And if there is such a God, apparently he doesn't really love you because he's not willing to stop the problems that afflict you. He just lets you suffer. What good person would do that? Or maybe he's just not powerful. Maybe he can't really stop it. And in which case, whether it's he doesn't love you or he's not powerful enough, in either case, he's not the God that these Christian theists think exists. Therefore, God probably doesn't exist. So there are a variety of different ways in which somebody could come to the point where they might profess, even if they don't believe it deep down inside, but they might at least profess that they don't believe in God. So those are four scenarios, okay. Herb. What do you think?
Okay. That's good, but you said something then that caught the mind. You say they say they may not, they do not love God. I mean, God do not love them. But it's not that God do not love them. Do they love God?
Right. No, what I'm saying here, and I've got to take a break, so forgive me. I'm talking about how some people might think. They might think, oh, well, there's evil in the world. So I guess God doesn't exist, because if he really did exist and he's loving, then why doesn't he love me enough to take my cancer away? Why doesn't he love me enough so that my child or my wife doesn't die? You see, so it's not a God problem, it's a human problem where we can make the mistake of thinking that God doesn't exist because of the problem of evil. I've got to leave it at that, Herb, though. I've got to take a break. Thank you for the call. Great topic. I'll be right back with more right after this. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. We're going to gallop to the finish line at the end of the hour here. Let's start off with Mary in California. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Mary. Patrick, I called some time ago about where in the Bible do you find that we have a personal guardian angel, and you said you would have to tell me the next day, and I missed you, so did you? I don't know. I didn't hear the answer.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry that it didn't come through that day. So it's Matthew chapter 18, verse 10. That's probably the most commonly cited passage, Mary. And there Jesus says, "See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven." So that one passage is not the only one. There are many passages that involve angels and how people are guarded by angels or led by angels, etc. But this one seems to be the most on point in that Jesus is talking about all these children who are gathered around him, and he's saying that they all have guardian angels. So by extension, the church infers that this is true of all people, that God gives a guardian angel to everybody. So that would be the passage that I think that we were looking for. Whoops, wrong Mary. Mary in California. Does that help?
Mary, is this Matthew 18?
Yes. The passage that I just mentioned to you is Matthew 18, verse 10.
Verse 10, yes, because right. A Protestant says, no, there's no such thing in the Bible. So I just want to make sure what I'm talking, what I'm going to ask. You know,
yeah, there
her.
You have it.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Mary. And for that, you know, for good measure, there's a great book by Joan Carol Cruz. It's called Angels and Devils, because Demons is the one by Dan Brown. That's a ridiculous book. But Angels and Devils by Joan Carol Cruz is a one-volume theology of angels, or angelology. And all the pertinent verses from the Holy Bible that deal with angels and our guardian angels, that's present in that book. And then the teachings of the church fathers, and then lives of the saints and ways in which angels have been manifested, that's all present. So if you want to be completely overpoweringly ready for your friend, if he ever says again that there's no such thing as guardian angels, that book will help you. Let's go now to Lori in Fort Myers, Florida. Good morning, Lori.
Hi, Patrick. I want to know, you always say to get, you personally get communion on the tongue. That is my preference as well. Have you or your family ever received it in the hand? Because every time you say that, I feel guilty, especially with this pandemic, because if everybody asked to get it on the tongue, that would take forever for the priest to have to do that.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'll just as an aside, I'll say I wouldn't agree with that assessment. It would take just as long to put it on your tongue as it would to put it in your hand. There's no significant time difference between the two, I would argue. Yes, I don't want to say I'm sorry to say, but I guess I might say I'm sorry to say. When I was a young adult and newly married with a couple of kids, I guess, there was a phase, especially we had some priests who were friends of ours who were kind of very far to the left. And although I had a really good solid Catholic foundation, for whatever reason, I wasn't as dialed in as a young adult as I think I became more as time went on. And so there, I'm thinking about one example, Lori, where one of these priests, he came to our home. He was invited. He came to our home and he celebrated Mass at our kitchen table. And I'm not happy about this in retrospect, but at the time I was oblivious enough that I just it didn't register with me. So he celebrated Mass at our kitchen table and we were all seated around the table. You know, there was no kneeling or anything like that. And when it came time for Holy Communion, he just simply leaned over and handed us a host. And I consumed the host. So I look back on that with regret. I wish I hadn't done that. But at the time, I was oblivious enough that it didn't register. And so, yeah, there were a few instances, not many at all, probably, I don't know, half a dozen times at most, maybe less than that, when I ever received Holy Communion in the hand. But it did happen.
With the pandemic, the priest doesn't give it on the tongue. He asks if you need it on the tongue to make an appointment. That's what I meant with more time needed.
Oh, okay. You know what? I've never even heard of that. I've heard that it's fairly common for the priest to say, if you want to receive Holy Communion on the tongue, come up to receive at the very end, and then we'll give you Holy Communion on the tongue. But I've never heard of anybody say, it seems ludicrous to me that the priest would say, if you want to receive communion on the tongue, make an appointment. That's, at first glance, ridiculous and completely unnecessary. Talk about an exaggerated response to COVID-19. But I've never heard of anyone doing that. But if it's happening where you are, I don't know what to tell you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Let's go to Mary in Chula Vista, California. Hi, Mary.
Hello, Patrick. I came in late for what you were talking about, the plenary indulgence for the divine mercy. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to know what the requirements were for that.
Okay, so the requirements for a plenary indulgence would differ depending upon, you know, what is the thing that's indulgent. So in the case of the Divine Mercy Sunday, to receive the plenary indulgence, the norms are that you have to have said the Divine Mercy Novena for those 9 days before,
right, okay.
So it begins on Good Friday. You have to have no attachment to sin. Now, that's not an emotion. That's not predicting the future. That's just saying, here and now, Lord, in this moment, right now, uh-huh. I not only desire to have no connection to any sin whatsoever, I also am sorry for all my past sins, and I take no pleasure in remembering them. I'm detached from them, and I hate my sins because I love you. And then you have to receive Holy Communion, go to Mass, receive Holy Communion, and go to confession within the octave. Now, that means within 8 days before or 8 days after, ideally on that day,
okay.
If possible. And confession, of course, is not likely to be able to be received on Divine Mercy Sunday, but the day before is certainly fine. And then you also have to pray for the Holy Father, you know, and Our Father, glory be, Hail Mary. Pray for the Holy Father and His intentions.
Confession. 3 weeks ago. So if I go like the week after next, after this coming Sunday.
Right, within the octave, within 8 days of
within
Divine
the
Mercy
octave.
Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
So that would be if I went the following Saturday.
That
Sunday,
would be within the octave,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah, you know, that would yeah. be within it.
And there's one other ingredient, Mary. Here's the other thing, is you have to desire to receive the indulgence. You have to ask, you have to want it.
Of course.
Yeah. So there you have it.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Thank you, Mary. Let's go now to Shirley, who's listening in West St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Shirley.
Good morning, Patrick. My question is, do you know or would you be able to find out if St. John Paul II had any other mysteries that he contemplated before he chose the luminous mysteries?
Interesting question. Well, he himself answers that very question in his encyclical Rosarium Virginis Mariae, the Rosary of the Virgin Mary. You can easily get it online in English. And I'm assuming you probably don't want to read it in Latin or Polish, but you can get it online in English. And he explains why he formulated the luminous mysteries of the Rosary. And I think by doing so, he indicates that he thinks this set of the incidents in the life of Christ were the ones that are really important for us to ponder as well. And there he does not suggest that I recall any other mysteries that he might have had in mind. So, you know, maybe in heaven you can ask him just to be sure, but I think that would be a sure guide. Rosarium Virginis Mariae would be the document where he tells you in his own words his thoughts on that issue. Thanks, Shirley. Let's go to Janet now. No, I'm sorry. Excuse me. I'm trying to get to the calls in order of how long they've been waiting. April in Scottsdale, thank you for calling and welcome.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you. I just called to comment about young couples that are deciding to not have children mm-hmm. just because they want to travel and all that stuff. Yeah. Well, I was the same when I was in my 20s. I was married for 16 years. And that's what my ex-husband and I decided to do. And I can tell you now without question, sure, we traveled. We went everywhere. We had a lot of material things. We had money. It's all overrated because now I'm divorced, 5 years divorced, have no children. Mm. And what I would do to change that, I would give it all back, all the traveling, all the money, all the stuff, because I guarantee you my life would be completely different. I deeply believe in my heart and my soul that God intended my life to be so much better than what yeah. I chose. And now I know that, you know, I'm in my early 40s. Mm-hmm. Lesson learned, but man, it's a tough lesson to learn.
Oh gosh, I can only imagine. Well, my heart goes out to you, April. You mentioned that you're divorced. You know, I'm assuming, just biology being what it is, that when a woman is in her early 40s, the so-called biological clock has more or less stopped ticking. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's mm-hmm. that's the tough part, you know, because I just know it was meant for more.
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your courage in sharing something so intimate with us. But I'm glad you did, because it's a good reminder to people who maybe are still in a position to not make the mistake that you made. And you know what, too, April? You can still be a mother in other ways. You probably already know this. You know, a mother and having a motherly role in the lives of your nieces and nephews or in other people that you can help. God has not forsaken you and abandoned you, and certainly, although your role as a mother will be different now than it might have been, he still has a plan for you. So please don't ever think that your opportunity to serve in that capacity in some sense has passed you by. It hasn't passed you by.
Well, thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome. God bless you. Sending you a big hug, April. Happy Easter. Chin up. It's going to be okay. God loves you. And I do too. And I'll be back with you all again tomorrow. Same Pat time, same Pat channel. Please pray for me in the meantime. I'll pray for you. Thanks, Cyrus. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, everybody. God bless you. La, 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 la.